concept of the saw,
as it was defined by Socrates, and I try to explain to you the importance of what Socrates discovered or invented with respect to the soul. I try to make it clear to you that no one before Socrates had so clearly and so passionately linked the soul with a person's intellectual and moral life, with decisions between good and evil, between knowledge and ignorance. No one before him had proclaimed the soul to be the true self in the sense in which we have been using the term in the Socratic context. And no one had called upon men before to take care of their souls, to give their souls all the care that they properly could. This meant a revolution in philosophy and in religion. Emerson has remarked that he had grave doubts about religion because, he said, he couldn't tell the difference between people who said they had religious beliefs and people who said they didn't have religious beliefs by the way they lived. It didn't seem to make any difference. Well, it was an important point that Emerson made here. Socrates wanted to see the difference in the lives of men who recognized the fact that they had souls which were the true selves of men in the care that they were taking of their souls. It was a revolutionary doctrine for its time, and even now it still sounds in many ways very fresh. The break that you find here with the past can be briefly summarized as follows in the light of what we've said in the last few weeks. First of all, the Socratic soul was quite different from any suggestion of a soul as one finds it in the ancient Greek literature, as in Homer, for example, or in the Bible, for that matter, as the identification of something that a man has with his life principle, something that gives him life, and that becomes a kind of a ghost after he dies. It makes no sense. It would have made no sense for people who had that kind of a belief about their souls to cry to them, take care of your souls. It would have been nonsense. And you don't find that kind of a cry in the literature before Socrates, whether among the Greeks or among the Hebrews. And secondly, when we get to a consideration, as we did, of the soul as it functioned in Orphism and in Pythagoreanism, there's a difference here, again, because there, while there was the cry, take care of your souls, what the Orphics and the Pythagoreans meant by that was that men should go through certain rites and rituals, certain ceremonies, to purify their souls. It had very little connection with a man's intellectual life, with a man's moral life. But in Socrates, the soul has everything to do with the rational activity of man. This is what makes a man, and with the way he lives morally. So this did mean a great revolution in philosophy, in religion, and in one's conception of one's own human nature and human condition. Now, this idea of Socrates has had great consequences. Let me only briefly touch on them by way of an overview summary. First, the Socratic view of the soul contributed greatly, immeasurably, to an intensified consciousness of the uniqueness and of the depth of a person's selfhood. Something which we take for granted today has, to a considerable degree, its roots in the life and work and thought and even death of Socrates. One is not merely a part of a tribe, of a family, of a nation, of a race. One is almost totally in himself, a world unto himself. He is his world. And he must live with the recognition of that fact. It is not the organic view of man that we talked about in another context, the larger whole of which man is only a small part, as in that beautiful passage from St. Paul that I read to you, and a lot of other expressions of that, and of course the whole concept of group consciousness that we talked about, which is pervasive in the Bible. Once you get the idea of a person being himself by reason of his individual soul, you have a different conception of man. And it's an extremely deepened and intensified conception of the selfhood. Secondly, through Socrates, the groundwork was laid for Judaism and Christianity developing the belief in the immortality of the soul. Once you believe in the soul, in the Socratic sense, then it is quite natural to move towards a belief in the soul's immortality. And this is what actually happened. And thirdly, the Socratic conception moved the differentiation, which we discussed time and again, between the realm of appearance and the realm of reality to the internal sphere. It took this very important, indispensable differentiation away from the outer realm and brought it into the inner realm. We saw how his predecessors, the pre-Socratic philosophers, dealt with that distinction. Reality is made up of atoms, never mind what reality may look like. Reality is made up of water or fire, air, earth and water, whatever. Or a fire alone, whatever the conception might have been. But it was all the differentiation with respect to outer phenomena. In the case of Socrates, that differentiation is internal. There is the ephemeral self. the phenomenal self, the self that comes and goes, that comes and passes away. That's not the real self. The real self isn't anything that anybody can see. But you have it. It's inside of you, and it's lasting. It endures. And that is the soul. And that is important. The external world is not really that important. Now, we'll come back to some of these conceptions, but at this point, again, only by way of an overview and by way of laying the ground for some later discussions, I want to point up to you a number of dangers that are inherent in this Socratic conception of the soul. Some of you probably feel towards these dangers by yourselves. They're not difficult to detect. Let me mention just two of them. First, this conception of the soul, the inner man, loosened man from the social group, which was the all-pervasive feeling and concept of man in the ancient world. Oh, there's a danger in this. The fellow man that we've talked about time and again now becomes just man. That is, he could become just man. We're dealing here with a lot of dangers here. It's a kind of a razor's edge operation. Depending on where you put the emphasis, depending on, by a hair's breadth, you can move one way or the other, and it would make all the difference here. The fellow man could now become only a man, unto himself. His relations with others can become now purely external, by way of agreement, like the social contract idea that we'll talk about some other time. Or, I make my fellow men by choosing to have a fellowship with certain men. With them, I have a fellowship. But it's dependent upon my voluntary act. It has nothing to do with my nature. My nature may be contrary as a matter. I may not want fellowship. And the self could be defined in such a way that the fellowship could be purely extrinsic to the nature of man. A matter of convenience. A matter of like and dislike, and nothing more important than that. And that could lead eventually into the capitalist conception of rugged individualism. A man standing alone, self-dependent, self-made. We'll see evidences of this in the modern period when we get into Locke, when we get into Emerson. A man doesn't need society. He makes a society. He can make a social group. He can make a state. He can make a government. He makes a church. He makes a congregation. Whatever it is, he makes it depending upon his own will. You can have some very complex combinations of ideas here. Not everything needs to be one thing or the other. The human mind has tried to find compromises, as in our own time, we try desperately to find compromises between things that we have, concepts that we've inherited, different strands that don't seem to want to live together, but we try to make them live together. Because we're groping towards a conception of man which will be congenial and wholesome and fulfilling to everybody and not merely to the isolated individuals. But we've got to go back first to the root idea, which you have so clearly stated in Socrates. And secondly, the other danger, we're going to run into this a little later in Stoicism and in things that are derivative from Marcus Aurelius's meditations and other Stoic philosophers, the sharp separation that could set in between the body and the soul, the Socratic emphasis on the soul, his great indifference to the body, as we saw. Bury me, he said. You never bury me. You bury a corpse. You bury a body. It means nothing to me. And a lot of other expressions that we have, which later on were developed by Plato and Neoplatonism. And a lot of this you find in Christianity and in some aspects of Judaism, a disparagement of the body, which can lead to another worldliness, a concentration, removing us from removing our interests, our concerns, our loyalties, our very stance from this world to another world. And religion can undergo a shift in interest from a concern with this world to otherworldliness, which is latent, of course. It's implicit in Socrates. It needn't be that, but there is that danger, and the danger has manifested itself time and again and again. But it goes back again, I say, to the original conception that we have here of the Socratic soul. Now, if I may, I would like to move on to some other aspects of Socrates, and I think when you get the totality, it will be more feasible for you to have a critical estimate of the Socratic contribution. Now, first then, we have dealt with the Socratic contribution by way of the invention or discovery of the soul. Now, secondly, I would say, as authorities have said time and again, that Socrates was the originator of what we could refer to as critical morality. I want to explain that. Hegel made a point of that, and it's a legitimate point. Let me explain what I mean. The Greeks, of course, like any other human society, had a system of morals. You can't be human without having a system of morals. But their morality was a customary morality, a morality that was inherited from generation, handed down from generation to generation. And largely it meant that people should do what they are expected to do, what people always, in quotation marks, do in that society. They have always done things this way. This is the way it's got to be done. These are the actions that have been approved in the past. These are the ways in which men should do things now. If one lives that way, not only society, but the gods approve of the person and his actions. This is a conventional kind of morality and a conventional kind of religion. Now, there were, besides Socrates, other voices, very few and far between, that were heard to question whether this is necessarily the best order, moral order. Some of the plays of Aeschylus in Sophocles, as we'll have a chance to see, and incidentally, I ought to explain that I took our readings of the Platonic dialogues out of order. I never know whether to do Plato first, Socrates first, or the plays of Sophocles. And almost unconsciously, I moved into Socrates by reason of the way the previous lectures had moved. We reached a point where it seemed to be entirely proper to pick up with Socrates. But it doesn't really matter. We have to consider them together. And in another day or two, we will pick up with Sophocles. Now, Sophocles, don't worry about your examination. We'll talk about that some other time. Sophocles raised some broad moral questions, tried to shake up some propositions from the point of view of morality and the religious order. But they did that, as we'll see, in the manner of the Old Testament prophets, not by way of a careful philosophical analysis, but as you have it in Job and as you have it in other biblical books, by way of a prophetic outcry. Very important, but it was a totally different kind of an approach from what we have in Socrates. In Socrates, for the first time, you have an attempt made at a critical analysis of moral concepts. To act on the basis of mere social custom or convention or habit or social acceptability, according to Socrates, was to act on the basis of mere ignorance, mere appearance. In the Apology, you remember the famous phrase, "The unexamined life is not worth living." Life has to be examined. The propositions which are thrust at one, the concepts, the ideals, cannot be accepted without question. They are of no credit to anyone who holds them unquestioningly. And Socrates followed his own maxim. He examined his own life. He examined every aspect of his own life. A man, according to Socrates, must constantly examine, ask questions, study, think. That's what makes him a man. The soul contained in itself, according to Socrates, the eternal truths. Because the soul is eternal. Its nature is therefore to be concerned with what is eternal. But how does one get at the eternal truths that are in one's soul? Only by probing. They're buried in one. One must mine them. There are treasures that are hidden in the person. They don't come to one readily. One must dig for them. One must work hard at getting them out. But they're in there. A person is rich with the eternal truths, if only he would work to get them out. Now, how do you go about doing that? According to Socrates, and this is the Socratic method that has come down to us with all its implications and its influences, you do it by asking others and by engaging in a discourse, a constant discourse with others. In this way, one learns for oneself. It isn't that you teach the other person, but the cooperative exchange makes it possible for me to arrive at what is already in me. Moral truths are not discovered, by the use of empirical methods, by conducting a Gallup poll or a statistical study. That's not the way at getting at the important truths. You can get at the appearances that way. In the Phaedrus, Socrates said, "Trees and fields tell me nothing. Men are my teachers." Here there was a break, as you see, between him and the pre-Socratic philosophers who were concerned about what is outside, about the empirical data, about measurements, and so on. They were concerned with physics, mathematics. He was not concerned with those. So, therefore, he wanted to learn from what people could offer him. They could offer him only help in getting at what is already inside himself. Socrates took seriously and literally the Oracle at Delphi, "Know thyself." This was the maxim at the Delphic Oracle, "Know thyself." He made that the key to his philosophy and his religion. But how do you know one? How do you know yourself? Of course, this is the hardest thing of all, as each one of you, I'm sure, has discovered for himself. How do you get to know yourself? This question of self-identification. Who am I? What am I? Today, the popular methods, as you know as well as I, are through psychiatry, through psychoanalysis, through depth psychology, through counseling, and other such methods. Socrates used the dialectic. We'll consider the dialectic in a little while. But here I want to stress his preoccupation with the moral self. The moral self is what put him on the quest for truths, for truth. His inquiry was conducted with an eye on what are the essential moral truths. What do they mean? How am I to live the good life? What is the good life? How does one know the difference between good and bad, good and evil? What you have here, of course, has become the basis for academic freedom, freedom of inquiry, freedom of inquiry in the humanities, in the social sciences, freedom of research, freedom of speech and the press. And Socrates, historically, is probably the first martyr to these important, what you might call, liberties of the mind. In the Apology, a passage that I read to you in another context. "And so, men of Athens," he said to the jury, "I say to you, do as Anytus, the prosecutor, bids, or not as Anytus bids. And either acquit me or not. But whichever you do, understand that I shall never alter my ways, not even if I have to die many times." And his ways were well known to the members of the jury. His ways was to conduct constant search with other people for the truth. And for the truths that mattered, like the question of what is good, what is evil, what is loyalty, and so on. And so you have here, as I say, in Socrates, a second tremendously important contribution. The origin of critical morality, subjecting questions of morality to the closest kind of intellectual examination. It's a totally different approach from what you have in the Bible. In the Bible, the Lord says, do this, don't do that. The law is clear. man has been told how to live, which a life which will be a blessing, and what to avoid, the doing of which would mean the curse. There is no examination and cross-examination there. In Socrates, you have nothing but examination and cross-examination. You have very little that constitutes a substantive philosophy. What you have is a method. And the emphasis was on method. The method itself was the great contribution. Now let me explain a third tremendously important contribution. Socrates contributed the Euthyphro, which you have in your readings, the first of the dialogues which you have. In the Euthyphro, Socrates tries to find out what is piety? When is a man rightly said to be pious? And when does he act impiously? Socrates says to Euthyphro, "So now I appeal to you to tell me what you were insisting just now that you definitely know. What do you mean by piety and impiety, both in respect of manslaughter and in all other connections?" Socrates again, "Then tell me, how do you define piety and impiety?" Euthyphro, "Very well. I say that piety consists in just what I am doing now, that is, prosecuting a wrongdoer for manslaughter or temple robbery or any other such crime, and that not to prosecute such a person is impious." So there you have the offer of a definition. Socrates, "Well then, do you recollect that what I urged you to do was not to tell me about one or two of these many pious actions?" Don't define the concept piety by simply giving me what you think is an instance of piety or an instance of impiety. It was not to tell me about one or two of these many pious actions, but to describe the actual feature that makes all pious actions pious. What's the essence of piety? What's the definition of piety? Don't give me examples. "Because you said, I believe, that impious actions are impious, and similarly pious ones are pious, in virtue of a single characteristic. Or don't you remember?" Euthyphro, "Very well then, what is agreeable to the gods is pious, and what is disagreeable to them, impious." So now you have another hypothesis offered. These are hypotheses which Socrates tests out. Socrates, "An excellent answer, Euthyphro, and in just the form that I wanted." That is, this is not now an example, but this is an attempt at a definition. "Whether it is true, I don't know yet, but no doubt you will go on to make it clear to me that your statement is correct." Then later on, Socrates, "On your view, my worthy Euthyphro, it follows that the gods, too, hold different opinions about what is right, and similarly about what is honorable and dishonorable, good and bad, because surely they would not be divided if they didn't disagree on these subjects. Isn't that so? That is, if pious is what the gods approve, impious is what the gods disapprove. Well, Socrates called his attention in the meantime that the gods are not in agreement on what is pious and what is impious. You can do something which will please one god, but by virtue of that act, you will be displeasing some other god, who will consider that an impious act as far as he is concerned. After all, there was a pantheon. The Greeks believed in many gods, and they didn't have a conclave at which they all agreed on a certain standard of conduct for human beings. They were partial. They took positions with respect that were contrary to one another with respect to human actions." So he calls this to the attention of Euthyphro now. "That in the light of that, do you mean what you say?" Socrates, "Then you didn't answer my question, my talented friend. I didn't ask you to tell me something which is actually at once both pious and impious, And apparently what is God beloved is also God hated. What you've done now is tell me that what is pious is at the same time impious, because one God says it's pious and another God says it's impious. So the same thing is both at the same time. Well, you can't have a definition like that. Of course, I omit a great deal, but I'm trying to pinpoint the essence of the method here. Euthyphro, later. Very well, I should say that piety is what all the gods love, and that the opposite, what all the gods hate, is impiety. Socrates, I rather think, Euthyphro, that when I asked you what piety is, you were unwilling to disclose its essence to me, and merely stated one of its attributes, that was before, as you saw, saying that piety has the attribute of being loved by all the gods. That's not the essence. But you have not yet told me what it is that has this attribute. What is it that the gods love? Do the gods love what is good, which makes the action pious? Or do the gods love whatever they love, which is pious, and that makes it good? Euthyphro, but this much I can tell you in general. If a man understands how to say and do in prayer and sacrifice what is pleasing to the gods, that is piety. Now he's gotten away from the original, from the other conception, after a good deal of argument that I omit here, of course. And now he is saying that the performance of prayer and sacrifice is pleasing to the gods, that's piety. And it is this sort of observance that preserves both private households and the public life of states. But the opposite of what is pleasing to the gods is impiety. And it is this that overturns and ruins everything. Socrates, so piety is what is gratifying to the gods, Euthyphro, but not beneficial nor dear to them? In my opinion, Euthyphro says, it is supremely dear to them, Socrates, that apparently piety is once more what is dear to the gods. Well, they end up by not agreeing, which is typical, but they've made a start. And they promise to resume the discourse, the inquiry, at some other point. It isn't that a dialogue necessarily reaches a conclusion. But what the dialogue has accomplished is that it has brought to the fore the difficulty of the problem. It's by no means easy to reach a definition of what is piety. At the end, this was accomplished, that both Socrates and Euthyphro knew that neither of them knew the right answer. When they started, Euthyphro thought he had the answer. Socrates knew he didn't have the answer. Now both of them knew that neither knew the answer. Now they were both conscious of their ignorance and both fully aware of the great difficulty in answering the question. Now, what this illustrates, and this is typical of the Socratic method, is that knowledge, important knowledge, that is in the field of moral concepts, important philosophical, religious concepts, is not to be acquired by doing what you're doing now, or what I'm doing to you, as my lecturing and you listening to a lecture. This is not the Socratic method. Of course, there's no help for it if you have 250 students to talk to. But from the Socratic point of view, knowledge must be, there's no escape for this, must be a personal achievement. The person himself must work out the problem and arrive, if at all possible, at the answer. There must be, therefore, self-criticism. The criticism must go on inside of himself. It's all right for Socrates to be there. He helps. But Socrates is engaged in the same inquiry as Euthyphro. He doesn't have any advantage in terms of having an answer. He doesn't have the answer either. He has an advantage in that he knows he doesn't know. And this is, of course, what Socrates claimed time and again, that he was the wisest man because he knew that he didn't know, while all the others thought that they knew. So philosophy in the Socratic dialogue and in the dialectic became a search. And it's been that ever since. Socrates was the first one to have used this conception of what has become known to us in a court of law as examination and cross-examination. But this was, of course, applied in all dialogues to all important concepts. So that what we have here is that a search for truth is at the same time a search for self-knowledge. And the two are inseparable. There's no other possible search for truth except through self-knowledge. It's a process whereby the person himself sees the contradictions, as Euthyphro had to see it, the contradictions that were exposed in his own thoughts and in his own beliefs. Now, this method was used by Plato and to a degree by Socrates in the Socratic dialogues for all kinds of concepts. For example, in Book One of the Republic, that very wonderful book, the examination of the concept of justice. And you see there the operation of the Socratic method in its nicest form. One definition after another that was offered and examined and rejected. A constant probing, searching. The concept was used as a hypothesis. It became, of course, the scientific method later when applied to the physical and biological sciences. You take a proposition, you consider it only a hypothesis, and you test it. Well, that's what you do in a laboratory. You start with some kind of an idea, and you test it. You see whether or not it holds up. And this is what Socrates did with the concepts. You say that piety is this, or you say justice is this, or as in many of the other dialogues, beauty or virtue, whatever it may be. Let's test it. What do you say it is? Then you try it out. And it doesn't fit, you reject it and try something else. And you keep trying and trying until maybe some kind of a consensus is reached. Often, it isn't done. Often the consensus is not reached. I wanted to conclude this. It'll take me only a few more seconds to do, but I'm afraid we don't have the time at this moment. I'll do that on Wednesday, but may I please have your attention? Our teaching assistants want to return to you the papers of the first examination. There's quite a spread of grades. There were 6 A's and 19 A minuses and 31 B pluses, 53 B's, 39 B minuses, 46 C pluses, 26 C's, and a number of other grades that were unmentionable. The ILR students will, if they don't make a rush for them, they'll find their papers in their boxes. The other students, the non-ILR students, if you will please follow these instructions. A through L on my right and M through Z on my left.